Why are so many dogs suffering from health issues? Actress Katherine Heigl, who's helped save over 16,000 dogs through her foundation, says she's seeing more issues with dogs' joints, odors, and health than ever before. And after doing a ton of research, she feels there's one place we can look to support any dog's health: their food. So she decided to create something she could actually feel good about feeding her dogs. It's called Superfood Complete. Superfood Complete is made with over 30 of the healthiest ingredients on the planet, including several superfoods vital to your dog's health. Badlands Ranch also sponsors the Jason Debus Heigl Foundation, which has helped rescue thousands of dogs and place them in loving homes. Dogs across America are trying this food and experiencing amazing health benefits. Go to badlandsranch.com/save50 and order right now to get up to 50% off your regular price order with a 90-day money-back guarantee. If you want your dog to experience all these incredible things, go to badlandsranch.com/save50 today.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Chapter 12 of Pellucidar by Edgar Rice Burroughs. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Pellucidar. Chapter 12. Kidnapped. I searched about the spot carefully. At last I was rewarded by the discovery of her javelin, a few yards from the bush that had concealed us from the charging Thag. Her javelin and the indications of a struggle, revealed by the trampled vegetation and the overlapping footprints of a woman and a man. Filled with consternation and dismay, I followed these latter to where they suddenly disappeared 100 yards from where the struggle had occurred. There I saw the huge imprints of a lady's feet. The story of the tragedy was all too plain. A Thurian had either been following us or had accidentally espied Dian and taken a fancy to her. While Juag and I had been engaged with the Thag, he had abducted her. I ran swiftly back to where Juag was working over the kill. As I approached him, I saw that something was wrong in this quarter as well, for the islander was standing upon the carcass of the Thag, his javelin poised for a throw. When I had come nearer, I saw the cause of his belligerent attitude. Just beyond him stood two large jaylocks, or wolf-dogs, regarding him intently, a male and a female. Their behavior was rather peculiar, for they did not seem preparing to charge him. Rather, they were contemplating him in an attitude of questioning. Juag heard me coming and turned toward me with a grin. These fellows love excitement. I could see by his expression that he was enjoying in anticipation the battle that seemed imminent. But he never hurled his javelin. A shout of warning from me stopped him, for I had seen the remnants of a rope dangling from the neck of the male jaylock. Juag again turned toward me, but this time in surprise. I was abreast him in a moment and, passing him, walked straight toward the two beasts. As I did so, the female crouched with bared fangs. The male, however, leapt forward to meet me, not in deadly charge, but with every expression of delight and joy which the poor animal could exhibit. It was Raja, the jaylock whose life I had saved and whom I then had tamed. There was no doubt that he was glad to see me. I now think that his seeming desertion of me had been but due to a desire to search out his ferocious mate and bring her, too, to live with me. When Juag saw me fondling the great beast, he was filled with consternation. But I did not have much time to spare to Raja while my mind was filled with the grief of my new loss. I was glad to see the brute, and I lost no time in taking him to Juag and making him understand that Juag too was to be Raja's friend. With the female the matter was more difficult, but Raja helped us out by growling savagely at her whenever she bared her fangs against us. I told Juag of the disappearance of Dian, and of my suspicions as to the explanation of the catastrophe. He wanted to start out right after her, but I suggested that with Raja to help me it might be as well were he to remain and skin the thag, remove its bladder, and then return to where we had hidden the canoe on the beach. And so it was arranged that he was to do this and await me there for a reasonable time. I pointed to a great lake upon the surface of the pendant world above us, telling him that if after this lake had appeared four times I had not returned, to go either by water or land to Sari and fetch Gak with an army. Then, calling Raja after me, I set out after Dian and her abductor. First I took the wolf-dog to the spot where the man had fought with Dian. A few paces behind us followed Raja's fierce mate. I pointed to the ground where the evidences of the struggle were plainest, and where the scent must have been strong to Raja's nostrils. Then I grasped the remnant of the leash that hung about his neck and urged him forward upon the trail. He seemed to understand. With nose to the ground he set out upon his task. Dragging me after him, he trotted straight out upon the leedy plains, turning his steps in the direction of the Thurian village. I could have guessed as much. Behind us trailed the female. After a while she closed upon us, until she ran quite close to me and at Raja's side. It was not long before she seemed as easy in my company as did her lord and master. We must have covered considerable distance at a very rapid pace, for we had re-entered the great shadow, when we saw a huge leedy ahead of us, moving leisurely across the level plain. Upon its back were two human figures. If I could have known that the Jaylocks would not harm Dian, I might have turned them loose upon the leedy and its master. But I could not know, and so dared take no chances. However, the matter was taken out of my hands presently, when Raja raised his head and caught sight of his quarry. With a lunge that hurled me flat and jerked the leash from my hand, he was gone with the speed of the wind after the giant leedy and its riders. At his side raced his shaggy mate, only a trifle smaller than he and no whit less savage. They did not give tongue until the leedy itself discovered them and broke into a lumbering, awkward, but nonetheless rapid gallop. Then the two hound-beasts commenced to bay, starting with a low, plaintive note that rose, weird and hideous, to terminate at a series of short, sharp yelps. I feared that it might be the hunting call of the pack, and if this were true, there would be slight chance for either Dian or her abductor, or myself either, as far as that was concerned. So I redoubled my efforts to keep pace with the hunt. But I might as well have attempted to distance the bird upon the wing. As I have often reminded you, I am no runner. In that instance it was just as well that I am not, for my very slowness of foot played into my hands. While had I been fleeter, I might have lost Dian that time forever. The leedy, with the hounds running close on either side, had almost disappeared in the darkness that enveloped the surrounding landscape, when I noted that it was bearing toward the right. This was accounted for by the fact that Raja ran upon its left side, and unlike his mate, kept leaping for the great beast's shoulder. The man on the leedy's back was prodding at the hyaenodon with his long spear, but still Raja kept springing up and snapping. The effect of this was to turn the leedy toward the right, and the longer I watched the procedure the more convinced I became that Raja and his mate were working together with some end in view. For the she-dog merely galloped steadily at the leedy's right, about opposite his rump. I had seen Jaylocks hunting in packs, and I recalled now what for the time I had not thought of, the several that ran ahead and turned the quarry back toward the main body. This was precisely what Raja and his mate were doing. they were turning the leady back toward me, or at least Raja was. Just why the female was keeping out of it I did not understand, unless it was that she was not entirely clear in her own mind as to precisely what her mate was attempting. At any rate, I was sufficiently convinced to stop where I was and await developments, for I could readily realize two things. One was that I could never overhaul them before the damage was done if they should pull the leady down now. The other thing was that if they did not pull it down for a few minutes, it would have completed its circle and returned close to where I stood. And this is just what happened. The lot of them were almost swallowed up in the twilight for a moment. Then they reappeared again, but this time far to the right and circling back in my direction. I waited until I could get some clear idea of the right spot to gain that I might intercept the leady. But even as I waited, I saw the beast attempt to turn still more to the right, a move that would have carried him far to my left in a much more circumscribed circle than the hyaenodons had mapped out for him. Then I saw the female leap forward and head him. And when he would have gone too far to the left, Raja sprang, snapping at his shoulder, and held him straight. Straight for me, the two savage beasts were driving their quarry. It was wonderful. It was something else, too, as I realized, while the monstrous beast neared me. It was like standing in the middle of the tracks in front of an approaching express train. But I didn't dare waver. Too much depended upon my meeting that hurtling mass of terrified flesh with a well-placed javelin. So I stood there, waiting to be run down and crushed by those gigantic feet, but determined to drive home my weapon in the broad breast before I fell. The leady was only about 100 yards from me when Raja gave a few barks in a tone that differed materially from his hunting cry. Instantly both he and his mate leapt for the long neck of the ruminant. Neither missed. Swinging in mid-air, they hung tenaciously, their weight dragging down the creature's head, and so retarding its speed that before it had reached me it was almost stopped, and devoting all its energies to attempting to scrape off its attackers with its forefeet. Dian had seen and recognized me, and was trying to extricate herself from the grasp of her captor, who, handicapped by a strong and agile prisoner, was unable to wield his lance effectively upon the two Jaylocks. At the same time I was running swiftly toward them. When the man discovered me he released his hold upon Dian and sprang to the ground, ready with his lance to meet me. My javelin was no match for his longer weapon, which was used more for stabbing than as a missile. Should I miss him at my first cast, as was quite probable, since he was prepared for me, I would have to face his formidable lance with nothing more than a stone knife. The outlook was scarcely entrancing. Evidently, I was soon to be absolutely at his mercy. Seeing my predicament, he ran toward me to get rid of one antagonist before he had to deal with the other two. He could not guess, of course, that the two Jaylocks were hunting with me. But he doubtless thought that after they had finished the leady they would make after the human prey. The beasts are notorious killers, often slaying wantonly. But as the Thurian came, Raja loosened his hold upon the leady and dashed for him, with the female close after. When the man saw them he yelled to me to help him, protesting that we should both be killed if we did not fight together. But I only laughed at him and ran toward Dian. Both the fierce beasts were upon the Thurian simultaneously. He must have died almost before his body tumbled to the ground. Then the female wheeled toward Dian. I was standing by her side as the thing charged her, my javelin ready to receive her. But again Raja was too quick for me. I imagined he thought she was making for me, for he couldn't have known anything of my relations toward Dian. At any rate, he leapt full upon her back and dragged her down. There ensued forthwith as terrible a battle as one would wish to see if battles were gauged by volume of noise and riotousness of action. I thought that both the beasts would be torn to shreds. When finally the female ceased to struggle and rolled over on her back, her forepaws limply folded, I was sure that she was dead. Raja stood over her, growling, his jaws close to her throat. Then I saw that neither of them bore a scratch. The male had simply administered a severe drubbing to his mate. It was his way of teaching her that I was sacred. After a moment he moved away and let her rise, when she set about smoothing down her rumpled coat, while he came stalking toward Dian and me. I had an arm about Dian now. As Raja came close, I caught him by the neck and pulled him up to me. There I stroked him and talked to him, bidding Dian do the same, until I think he pretty well understood that if I was his friend, so was Dian. For a long time he was inclined to be shy of her, often baring his teeth at her approach, and it was a much longer time before the female made friends with us. But by careful kindness, by never eating without sharing our meat with them, and by feeding them from our hands, we finally won the confidence of both animals. However, that was a long time after. With the two beasts trotting after us, we returned to where we had left Juwag. Here I had the Dickens' own time keeping the female from Juwag's throat. Of all the venomous, wicked, cruel-hearted beasts on two worlds, I think a female hyaenodon takes the palm. But eventually she tolerated Juwag as she had Dian and me, and the five of us set out toward the coast, for Juwag had just completed his labors on the Thag when we arrived. We ate some of the meat before starting and gave the hound some. All that we could we carried upon our backs. On the way to the canoe we met with no mishaps. Dian told me that the fellow who had stolen her had come upon her from behind while the roaring of the Thag had drowned all other noises, and that the first she had known he had disarmed her and thrown her to the back of his leady, which had been lying down close by waiting for him. By the time the Thag had ceased bellowing, the fellow had got well away upon his swift mount. By holding one palm over her mouth he had prevented her calling for help. "I thought," she concluded, "that I should have to use the viper's tooth after all." We reached the beach at last and unearthed the canoe. Then we busied ourselves stepping a mast and rigging a small sail—Juwag and I, that is—while Dian cut the Thag meat into long strips for drying when we should be out in the sunlight once more. At last all was done. We were ready to embark. I had no difficulty in getting Raja aboard the dugout, but Rani, as we christened her after I had explained to Dian the meaning of Raja and its feminine equivalent, positively refused for a time to follow her mate aboard. In fact, we had to shove off without her. After a moment, however, she plunged into the water and swam after us. I let her come alongside, and then Juwag and I pulled her in, she snapping and snarling at us as we did so. But, strange to relate, she didn't offer to attack us after we had ensconced her safely in the bottom alongside Raja. The canoe behaved much better under sail than I had hoped, infinitely better than the battleship Sari had, and we made good progress almost due west across the gulf, upon the opposite side of which I hoped to find the mouth of the river of which Juwag had told me. The islander was much interested and impressed by the sail and its results. He had not been able to understand exactly what I had hoped to accomplish with it while we were fitting up the boat, but when he saw the clumsy dugout move steadily through the water without paddles, he was as delighted as a child. We made splendid headway on the trip, coming into sight of land at last. Juwag had been terror-stricken when he had learned that I intended crossing the ocean, and when we passed out of sight of land he was in a blue funk. He said that he had never heard of such a thing before in his life, and that always he had understood that those who ventured far from land never returned. For how could they find their way when they could see no land to steer for? I tried to explain the compass to him, and though he never really grasped the scientific explanation of it, yet he did learn to steer by it quite as well as I. We passed several islands on the journey, islands which Juwag told me were entirely unknown to his own island folk. Indeed, our eyes may have been the first ever to rest upon them. I should have liked to stop off and explore them, but the business of empire would brook no unnecessary delays. I asked Juag how Hooja expected to reach the mouth of the river which we were in search of if he didn't cross the gulf, and the islander explained that Hooja would undoubtedly follow the coast around. For some time we sailed up the coast searching for the river, and at last we found it. So great was it that I thought it must be a mighty gulf, until the mass of driftwood that came out upon the first ebb tide convinced me that it was the mouth of a river. There were the trunks of trees uprooted by the undermining of the river banks, giant creepers, flowers, grasses, and now and then the body of some land animal or bird. I was all excitement to commence our upward journey when there occurred that which I had never before seen within Pellucidar, a really terrific windstorm. It blew down the river upon us with a ferocity and suddenness that took our breaths away, and before we could get a chance to make the shore it became too late. The best that we could do was to hold the scudding craft before the wind and race along in a smother of white spume. Juag was terrified. If Dian was, she hid it. For was she not the daughter of a once great chief, the sister of a king, and the maid of an emperor? Raja and Rani were frightened. The former crawled close to my side and buried his nose against me. Finally, even fierce Rani was moved to seek sympathy from a human being. She slunk to Dian, pressing close against her and whimpering, while Dian stroked her shaggy neck and talked to her as I talked to Raja. There was nothing for us to do but try to keep the canoe right side up and straight before the wind. For what seemed an eternity the tempest neither increased nor abated. I judged that we must have blown 100 miles before the wind and straight out into an unknown sea. As suddenly as the wind rose, it died again, and when it died it veered to blow at right angles to its former course in a gentle breeze. I asked Juag then what our course was, for he had had the compass last. It had been on a leather thong about his neck. When he felt for it, the expression that came into his eyes told me as plainly as words what had happened. The compass was lost. The compass was lost! And we were out of sight of land without a single celestial body to guide us. Even the pendant world was not visible from our position. Our plight seemed hopeless to me, but I dared not let Dian and Juag guess how utterly dismayed I was. Though, as I soon discovered, there was nothing to be gained by trying to keep the worst from Juag. He knew it quite as well as I. He had always known, from the legends of his people, the dangers of the open sea beyond the side of land. The compass, since he had learned its uses from me, had been all that he had to buoy his hope of eventual salvation from the watery deep. He had seen how it had guided me across the water to the very coast that I desired to reach, and so he had implicit confidence in it. Now that it was gone, his confidence had departed also. There seemed but one thing to do. That was to keep on sailing straight before the wind, since we could travel most rapidly along that course, until we sighted land of some description. If it chanced to be the mainland, well and good. If an island, well, we might live upon an island. We certainly could not live long in this little boat, with only a few strips of dried thag and a few quarts of water left. Quite suddenly a thought occurred to me. I was surprised that it had not come before as a solution to our problem. I turned toward Juag. "You Pellucidarians are endowed with a wonderful instinct," I reminded him. "An instinct that points the way straight to your homes, no matter in what strange land you may find yourself. Now all we have to do is let Dian guide us toward Amaz, and we shall come in a short time to the same coast whence we just were blown." As I spoke I looked at them with a smile of renewed hope, but there was no answering smile in their eyes. It was Dian who enlightened me. "We could do all this upon land," she said. "But upon the water that power is denied us. I do not know why, but I have always heard that this is true, that only upon the water may a Pellucidarian be lost. This is, I think, why we all fear the great ocean so, even those who go upon its surface in canoes. Juag has told us that they never go beyond the sight of land. We had lowered the sail after the blow while we were discussing the best course to pursue. Our little craft had been drifting idly, rising and falling with the great waves that were now diminishing. Sometimes we were upon the crest, again in the hollow. As Dian ceased speaking, she let her eyes range across the limitless expanse of billowing waters. We rose to a great height upon the crest of a mighty wave. As we topped it, Dian gave an exclamation and pointed astern. "Boats!" she cried. "Boats! Many, many boats!" Juag and I leapt to our feet, but our little craft had now dropped to the trough, and we could see nothing but walls of water close upon either hand. We waited for the next wave to lift us, and when it did we strained our eyes in the direction that Dian had indicated. Sure enough, scarce half a mile away were several boats, and scattered far and wide behind us as far as we could see were many others. We could not make them out in the distance or in the brief glimpse that we caught of them before we were plunged again into the next wave canyon, but they were boats, and in them must be human beings like ourselves. End of chapter 12. Chapter 13 of Pellucidar by Edgar Rice Burroughs. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Pellucidar, Chapter 13, Racing for Life. At last the sea subsided, and we were able to get a better view of the armada of small boats in our wake. There must have been 200 of them. Juag said that he had never seen so many boats before in all his life. Where had they come from? Juag was first to hazard a guess. "Huja," he said, "was building many boats to carry his warriors to the great river and up it toward Sari. He was building them with almost all his warriors and many slaves upon the Island of Trees. No one else in all the history of Pellucidar has ever built so many boats as they told me Huja was building. These must be Huja's boats."
"And they were blown out to sea by the great storm just as we were," suggested Dian.
"There can be no better explanation of them," I agreed. "What shall we do?" asked Juag.
"Suppose we make sure that they really are Huja's people," suggested Dian. "It may be that they are not, and that if we run away from them before we learn definitely who they are, we shall be running away from a chance to live and find the mainland. They may be a people of whom we have never even heard, and if so, we can ask them to help us, if they know the way to the mainland."
"Which they will not," interposed Juag. "Well," I said, "it can't make our predicament any more trying to wait until we find out who they are. They are heading for us now. Evidently they have spied our sail, and guessed that we do not belong to their fleet."
"They probably want to ask the way to the mainland themselves," said Juag, who was nothing if not a pessimist.
"If they want to catch us, they can do it if they paddle faster than we can sail," I said. "If we let them come close enough to discover their identity, and can then sail faster than they can paddle, we can get away from them anyway, so we might as well wait."
And wait we did.
The sea calmed rapidly, so that by the time the foremost canoe had come within 500 yards of us, we could see them all plainly. Every one was headed for us. The dugouts, which were of unusual length, were manned by 20 paddlers, 10 to a side. Besides the paddlers, there were 25 or more warriors in each boat. When the leader was 100 yards from us, Dian called our attention to the fact that several of her crew were Sagoths. That convinced us that the flotilla was indeed Huja's. I told Juag to hail them and get what information he could, while I remained in the bottom of our canoe as much out of sight as possible. Dian lay down at full length in the bottom. I did not want them to see and recognize her if they were in truth Huja's people.
"Who are you?"
shouted Juag, standing up in the boat and making a megaphone of his palms. A figure arose in the bow of the leading canoe,
a figure that I was sure I recognized even before he spoke.
"I am Hooja!"
cried the man in answer to Juag. For some reason he did not recognize his former prisoner and slave, possibly because he had so many of them.
"I come from the Island of Trees," he continued. "A hundred of my boats were lost in the great storm, and all their crews drowned. Where is the land? What are you, and what strange thing is that which flutters from the little tree in the front of your canoe?"
He referred to our sail, flapping idly in the wind.
"We too are lost," replied Juag. "We know not where the land is. We are going back to look for it now."
So saying, he commenced to scull the canoe's nose before the wind, while I made fast the primitive sheets that held our crude sail. We thought it time to be going. There wasn't much wind at the time, and the heavy, lumbering dugout was slow in getting under way. I thought it never would gain any momentum. And all the while Hooja's canoe was drawing rapidly nearer, propelled by the strong arms of his 20 paddlers. Of course, their dugout was much larger than ours, and consequently infinitely heavier and more cumbersome. Nevertheless, it was coming along at quite a clip, and ours was yet but barely moving. Dean and I remained out of sight as much as possible, for the two craft were now well within bowshot of one another, and I knew that Hooja had archers. Hooja called to Juag to stop when he saw that our craft was moving. He was much interested in the sail, and not a little awed, as I could tell by his shouted remarks and questions. Raising my head, I saw him plainly. He would have made an excellent target for one of my guns, and I had never been sorrier that I had lost them. We were now picking up speed a trifle, and he was not gaining upon us so fast as at first. In consequence, his requests that we stop suddenly changed to commands as he became aware that we were trying to escape him.
"Come back!" he shouted. "Come back, or I'll fire!"
I use the word fire because it more nearly translates into English the Pellucidarian word trag, which covers the launching of any deadly missile. But Juag only seized his paddle more tightly, the paddle that answered the purpose of rudder, and commenced to assist the wind by vigorous strokes. Then Hooja gave the command to some of his archers to fire upon us. I couldn't lie hidden in the bottom of the boat, leaving Juag alone exposed to the deadly shafts, so I arose and, seizing another paddle, set to work to help him. Dean joined me, though I did my best to persuade her to remain sheltered, but being a woman she must have her own way. The instant that Hooja saw us he recognized us. The whoop of triumph he raised indicated how certain he was that we were about to fall into his hands. A shower of arrows fell about us. Then Hooja caused his men to cease firing. He wanted us alive. None of the missiles struck us, for Hooja's archers were not nearly the marksmen that are my Sarians and Amozites. We had gained sufficient headway to hold our own on about even terms with Hooja's paddlers. We did not seem to be gaining, though, and neither did they. How long this nerve-racking experience lasted I cannot guess, though we had pretty nearly finished our meager supply of provisions when the wind picked up a bit and we commenced to draw away. Not once yet had we sighted land, nor could I understand it, since so many of the seas I had seen before were thickly dotted with islands. Our plight was anything but pleasant, yet I think that Hooja and his forces were even worse off than we, for they had no food nor water at all. Far out behind us, in a long line that curved upward in the distance, to be lost in the haze, strung Hooja's 200 boats. But one would have been enough to have taken us could it have come alongside. We had drawn some 50 yards ahead of Hooja. There had been times when we were scarce 10 yards in advance, and were feeling considerably safer from capture. Hooja's men, working in relays, were commencing to show the effects of the strain under which they had been forced to work without food or water, and I think their weakening aided us almost as much as the slight freshening of the wind. Hooja must have commenced to realize that he was going to lose us, for he again gave orders that we be fired upon. Volley after volley of arrows struck about us. The distance was so great by this time that most of the arrows fell short, while those that reached us were sufficiently spent to allow us to ward them off with our paddles. However, it was a most exciting ordeal. Hooja stood in the bow of his boat, alternately urging his men to greater speed and shouting epithets at me. But we continued to draw away from him. At last the wind rose to a fair gale, and we simply raced away from our pursuers as if they were standing still. Juag was so tickled that he forgot all about his hunger and thirst. I think that he had never been entirely reconciled to the heathenish invention which I called a sail, and that down in the bottom of his heart he believed that the paddlers would eventually overhaul us, but now he couldn't praise it enough. We had a strong gale for a considerable time, and eventually dropped Hooja's fleet so far astern that we could no longer discern them. And then, ah, I shall never forget that moment, Dian sprang to her feet with a cry of, "Land!" Sure enough, dead ahead, a long, low coast stretched across our bow. It was still a long way off, and we couldn't make out whether it was island or mainland, but at least it was land. If ever shipwrecked mariners were grateful, we were then. Raja and Rani were commencing to suffer for lack of food, and I could swear that the latter often cast hungry glances upon us, though I am equally sure that no such hideous thoughts ever entered the head of her mate. We watched them both most closely, however. Once, while stroking Rani, I managed to get a rope around her neck and make her fast to the side of the boat. Then I felt a bit safer for Dian. It was pretty close quarters in that little dugout for three human beings and two practically wild, man-eating dogs. But we had to make the best of it, since I would not listen to Juag's suggestion that we kill and eat Raja and Rani. We made good time to within a few miles of the shore. Then the wind died suddenly out. We were all of us keyed up to such a pitch of anticipation that the blow was doubly hard to bear. And it was a blow, too, since we could not tell in what quarter the wind might rise again. But Juag and I set to work to paddle the remaining distance. Almost immediately the wind rose again from precisely the opposite direction from which it had formerly blown, so that it was mighty hard work making progress against it. Next it veered again, so that we had to turn and run with it parallel to the coast, to keep from being swamped in the trough of the seas. And while we were suffering all these disappointments, Hooja's fleet appeared in the distance. They evidently had gone far to the left of our course, for they were now almost behind us as we ran parallel to the coast. But we were not much afraid of being overtaken in the wind that was blowing. The gale kept on increasing, but it was fitful, swooping down upon us in great gusts and then going almost calm for an instant. It was after one of these momentary calms that the catastrophe occurred. Our sail hung limp and our momentum decreased when of a sudden a particularly vicious squall caught us. Before I could cut the sheets, the mast had snapped at the thwart in which it was stepped. The worst had happened. Juag and I seized the paddles and kept the canoe with the wind, but that squall was the parting shot of the gale, which died out immediately after, leaving us free to make for the shore, which we lost no time in attempting. But Hooja had drawn closer in toward shore than we, so it looked as if he might head us off before we could land. However, we did our best to distance him, Dian taking a paddle with us. We were in a fair way to succeed when there appeared, pouring from among the trees beyond the beach, a horde of yelling, painted savages, brandishing all sorts of devilish-looking primitive weapons. So menacing was their attitude that we realized at once the folly of attempting to land among them. Hooja was drawing closer to us. There was no wind. We could not hope to out-paddle him. And with our sail gone, no wind would help us, though, as if in derision at our plight, a steady breeze was now blowing. But we had no intention of sitting idle while our fate overtook us, so we bent to our paddles and, keeping parallel with the coast, did our best to pull away from our pursuers. It was a grueling experience. We were weakened by lack of food. We were suffering the pangs of thirst. Capture and death were close at hand. Yet I think that we gave a good account of ourselves in our final effort to escape. Our boat was so much smaller and lighter than any of Hooja's that the three of us forced it ahead almost as rapidly as his larger craft could go under their 20 paddles. As we raced along the coast for one of those seemingly interminable periods that may draw hours into eternities, where the labor is soul-searing and there is no way to measure time, I saw what I took for the opening to a bay or the mouth of a great river a short distance ahead of us. I wished that we might make for it, but with the menace of Hooja close behind and the screaming natives who raced along the shore parallel to us, I dared not attempt it. We were not far from shore in that mad flight from death. Even as I paddled, I found opportunity to glance occasionally toward the natives. They were white, but hideously painted. From their gestures and weapons, I took them to be a most ferocious race. I was rather glad that we had not succeeded in landing among them. Hooja's fleet had been in much more compact formation when we sighted them this time than on the occasion following the tempest. Now they were moving rapidly in pursuit of us, all well within the radius of a mile. Five of them were leading, all abreast, and were scarce 200 yards from us. When I glanced over my shoulder, I could see that the archers had already fitted arrows to their bows in readiness to fire upon us the moment that they should draw within range. Hope was low in my breast. I could not see the slightest chance of escaping them, for they were overhauling us rapidly now, since they were able to work their paddles in relays while we three were rapidly wearying beneath the constant strain that had been put upon us. It was then that Juag called my attention to the rift in the shoreline which I thought either a bay or the mouth of a great river. There I saw moving slowly out into the sea that which filled my soul with wonder. End of chapter 13. Chapter 14 of Pellucidar by Edgar Rice Burroughs. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Pellucidar. Chapter 14. Gore and Dreams. It was a two-masted felucca with lateen sails. The craft was long and low. In it were more than 50 men, 20 or 30 of whom were at oars with which the craft was being propelled from the lee of the land. I was dumbfounded. Could it be that the savage, painted natives I had seen on the shore had so perfected the art of navigation that they were masters of such advanced building and rigging as this craft proclaimed? It seemed impossible. And as I looked, I saw another of the same type swing into view and follow its sister through the narrow strait out into the ocean. Nor were these all. One after another, following closely upon one another's heels, came 50 of the trim, graceful vessels. They were cutting in between Hooja's fleet and our little dugout. When they came a bit closer, my eyes fairly popped from my head at what I saw, for in the eye of the leading felucca stood a man with a sea-glass leveled upon us. Who could they be? Was there a civilization within Pellucidar of such wondrous advancement as this? Were there far distant lands of which none of my people had ever heard, where a race had so greatly outstripped all other races of this inner world? The man with the glass had lowered it and was shouting to us. I could not make out his words, but presently I saw that he was pointing aloft. When I looked, I saw a pennant fluttering from the peak of the forward lateen yard, a red, white, and blue pennant, with a single great white star in a field of blue. Then I knew. My eyes went even wider than they had before. It was the navy! It was the navy of the Empire of Pellucidar, which I had instructed Perry to build in my absence. It was my navy! I dropped my paddle and stood up and shouted and waved my hand. Juag and Dian looked at me as if I had gone suddenly mad. When I could stop shouting, I told them, and they shared my joy and shouted with me. But still Hooja was coming nearer, nor could the leading felucca overhaul him before he would be alongside or at least within bowshot. Hooja must have been as much mystified as we were as to the identity of the strange fleet, but when he saw me waving to them he evidently guessed that they were friendly to us, so he urged his men to redouble their efforts to reach us before the felucca cut him off. He shouted word back to the others of his fleet, word that was passed back until it reached them all, directing them to run alongside the strangers and board them, for with his 200 craft and his 8,000 or 10,000 warriors he evidently felt equal to overcoming the 50 vessels of the enemy, which did not seem to carry over 3,000 men all told. His own personal energies he bent to reaching Dian and me first, leaving the rest of the work to his other boats. I thought that there could be but little doubt that he would be successful in so far as we were concerned, and I feared for the revenge that he might take upon us should the battle go against his force, as I was sure it would. For I knew that Parry and his mesops must have brought with them all the arms and ammunition that had been contained in the prospector. But I was not prepared for what happened next. As Hooge's canoe reached a point some 20 yards from us, a great puff of smoke broke from the bow of the leading felucca, followed almost simultaneously by a terrific explosion, and a solid shot screamed close over the heads of the men in Hooge's craft, raising a great splash where it clove the water just beyond them. Parry had perfected gunpowder and built cannon. It was marvelous. Dian and Juag, as much surprised as Hooge, turned wondering eyes toward me. Again the cannon spoke. I suppose that by comparison with the great guns of modern naval vessels of the outer world it was a pitifully small and inadequate thing, but here in Pellucidar, where it was the first of its kind, it was about as awe-inspiring as anything you might imagine. With the report, an iron cannonball about 5 inches in diameter struck Hooge's dugout just above the waterline, tore a great splintering hole in its side, turned it over, and dumped its occupants into the sea. The 4 dugouts that had been abreast of Hooge had turned to intercept the leading felucca. Even now, in the face of what must have been a withering catastrophe to them, they kept bravely on toward the strange and terrible craft. In them were fully 200 men, while but 50 lined the gunwale of the felucca to repel them. The commander of the felucca, who proved to be Jah, let them come quite close and then turned loose upon them a volley of shots from small arms. The cavemen and Sagoths in the dugouts seemed to wither before that blast of death like dry grass before a prairie fire. Those who were not hit dropped their bows and javelins, and seizing upon paddles, attempted to escape. But the felucca pursued them relentlessly, her crew firing at will. At last I heard Jah shouting to the survivors in the dugouts. They were all quite close to us now, offering them their lives if they would surrender. Parry was standing close behind Jah, and I knew that this merciful action was prompted, perhaps commanded, by the old man, for no Pellucidarian would have thought of showing leniency to a defeated foe. As there was no alternative save death, the survivors surrendered and a moment later were taken aboard the Amaz, the name that I could now see printed in large letters upon the felucca's bow, and which no one in that whole world could read except Parry and I. When the prisoners were aboard, Jah brought the felucca alongside our dugout. Many were the willing hands that reached down to lift us to her decks. The bronze faces of the mesops were broad with smiles, and Parry was fairly beside himself with joy. Dian went aboard first, and then Juag, as I wished to help Rajah and Rani aboard myself, well knowing that it would fare ill with any mesop who touched them. We got them aboard at last, and a great commotion they caused among the crew, who had never seen a wild beast thus handled by man before. Parry and Dian and I were so full of questions that we fairly burst, but we had to contain ourselves for a while, since the battle with the rest of Hooge's fleet had scarce commenced. From the small forward decks of the feluccas, Parry's crude cannon were belching smoke, flame, thunder, and death. The air trembled to the roar of them. Hooge's horde, intrepid, savage fighters that they were closing in to grapple in a last death struggle with the mesops who manned our vessels. The handling of our fleet by the Red Island warriors of Jah's clan was far from perfect. I could see that Parry had lost no time after the completion of the boats in setting out upon this cruise. What little the captains and crews had learned of handling feluccas, they must have learned principally since they embarked upon this voyage. And while experience is an excellent teacher and had done much for them, they still had a great deal to learn. In maneuvering for position, they were continually fouling one another, and on two occasions shot from our batteries came near to striking our own ships. No sooner, however, was I aboard the flagship than I attempted to rectify this trouble to some extent. By passing commands by word of mouth from one ship to another, I managed to get the 50 feluccas into some sort of line, with the flagship in the lead. In this formation we commenced slowly to circle the position of the enemy. The dugouts came for us right along in an attempt to board us, but by keeping on the move in one direction and circling, we managed to avoid getting in each other's way and were enabled to fire our cannon and our small arms with less danger to our own comrades. When I had a moment to look about me, I took in the felucca on which I was. I am free to confess that I marveled at the excellent construction and staunch yet speedy lines of the little craft. That Perry had chosen this type of vessel seemed rather remarkable, for though I had warned him against turreted battleships, armor, and like useless show, I had fully expected that when I beheld his navy I should find considerable attempt at grim and terrible magnificence, for it was always Perry's idea to overawe these ignorant cavemen when we had to contend with them in battle. But I had soon learned that while one might easily astonish them with some new engine of war, it was an utter impossibility to frighten them into surrender. I learned later that Jaw had gone carefully over the plans of various craft with Perry. The old man had explained in detail all that the text told him of them. The two had measured out dimensions upon the ground, that Jaw might see the sizes of different boats. Perry had built models, and Jaw had had him read carefully and explain all that they could find relative to the handling of sailing vessels. The result of this was that Jaw was the one who had chosen the felucca. It was well that Perry had had so excellent a balance wheel, for he had been wild to build a huge frigate of the Nelsonian era, he told me so himself. One thing that had inclined Jaw particularly to the felucca was the fact that it included oars in its equipment. He realized the limitations of his people in the matter of sails, and while they had never used oars, the implement was so similar to a paddle that he was sure they quickly could master the art, and they did. As soon as one hull was completed, Jaw kept it on the water constantly, first with one crew and then with another, until 2,000 Red Warriors had learned to row. Then they stepped their masts and a crew was told off for the first ship. While the others were building, they learned to handle theirs. As each succeeding boat was launched, its crew took it out and practiced with it under the tutorage of those who had graduated from the first ship, and so on until a full complement of men had been trained for every boat. Well, to get back to the battle. The Hoojans kept on coming at us, and as fast as they came we mowed them down. It was little else than slaughter. Time and time again I cried to them to surrender, promising them their lives if they would do so. At last there were but 10 boatloads left. These turned in flight. They thought they could paddle away from us. It was pitiful. I passed the word from boat to cease firing, not to kill another Hoojan unless they fired on us. Then we set out after them. There was a nice little breeze blowing, and we bowled along after our quarry as gracefully and as lightly as swans upon a park lagoon. As we approached them, I could see not only wonder but admiration in their eyes. I hailed the nearest dugout. "Throw down your arms and come aboard us," I cried, "and you shall not be harmed. We will feed you and return you to the mainland. Then you shall go free upon your promise never to bear arms against the Emperor of Pellucidar again." I think it was the promise of food that interested them most. They could scarce believe that we would not kill them. But when I exhibited the prisoners we already had taken and showed them that they were alive and unharmed, a great Sagoth in one of the boats asked me what guarantee I could give that I would keep my word. "None other than my word," I replied. "That I do not break." The Pellucidarians themselves are rather punctilious about this same matter, so the Sagoth could understand that I might possibly be speaking the truth. But he could not understand why we should not kill them unless we meant to enslave them, which I had as much denied already when I had promised to set them free. Ja couldn't exactly see the wisdom of my plan either. He thought that we ought to follow up the 10 remaining dugouts and sink them all, but I insisted that we must free as many as possible of our enemies upon the mainland. "You see," I explained, "these men will return at once to Hooja's Island, to the Mahar cities from which they come, or to the countries from which they were stolen by the Mahars. They are men of two races and of many countries. They will spread the story of our victory far and wide, and while they are with us, we will let them see and hear many other wonderful things which they may carry back to their friends and their chiefs. It's the finest chance for free publicity, Perry," I added to the old man, "that you or I have seen in many a day." Perry agreed with me. As a matter of fact, he would have agreed to anything that would have restrained us from killing the poor devils who fell into our hands. He was a great fellow to invent gunpowder and firearms and cannon, but when it came to using these things to kill people, he was as tender-hearted as a chicken. The Sagoth who had spoken was talking to other Sagoths in his boat. Evidently they were holding a council over the question of the wisdom of surrendering. "What will become of you if you don't surrender to us?" I asked. "If we do not open up our batteries on you again and kill you all, you will simply drift about the sea helplessly until you die of thirst and starvation. You cannot return to the islands, for you have seen as well as we that the natives there are very numerous and warlike. They would kill you the moment you landed." The upshot of it was that the boat of which the Sagoth speaker was in charge surrendered. The Sagoths threw down their weapons, and we took them aboard the ship next in line behind the Amaz. First, Ja had to impress upon the captain and crew of the ship that the prisoners were not to be abused or killed. After that, the remaining dugouts paddled up and surrendered. We distributed them among the entire fleet, lest there be too many upon any one vessel. Thus ended the first real naval engagement that the Pellucidarian seas had ever witnessed, though Perry still insists that the action in which the Sari took part was a battle of the first magnitude. The battle over, and the prisoners disposed of and fed, and do not imagine that Dian, Juag, and I, as well as the two hounds, were not fed also, I turned my attention to the fleet. We had the feluccas close in about the flagship, and with all the ceremony of a medieval potentate on parade I received the commanders of the 49 feluccas that accompanied the flagship, Dian and I together, the Empress and the Emperor of Pellucidar. It was a great occasion. The savage bronze warriors entered into the spirit of it, for, as I learned later, dear old Perry had left no opportunity neglected for impressing upon them that David was Emperor of Pellucidar, and that all that they were accomplishing and all that he was accomplishing was due to the power and redounded to the glory of David. The old man must have rubbed it in pretty strong, for those fierce warriors nearly came to blows in their efforts to be among the first of those to kneel before me and kiss my hand. When it came to kissing Dian's, I think they enjoyed it more. I know I should have. A happy thought occurred to me as I stood upon the little deck of the Amaz with the first of Perry's primitive cannon behind me. When Ja kneeled at my feet, and first to do me homage, I drew from its scabbard at his side the sword of hammered iron that Perry had taught him to fashion. Striking him lightly on the shoulder, I created him King of Anorak. Each captain of the 49 other feluccas I made a duke. I left it to Perry to enlighten them as to the value of the honors I had bestowed upon them. During these ceremonies, Raja and Rani had stood beside Dian and me. Their bellies had been well filled, but still they had difficulty in permitting so much edible humanity to pass unchallenged. It was a good education for them, though, and never after did they find it difficult to associate with the human race without arousing their appetites. After the ceremonies were over, we had a chance to talk with Perry and Ja. The former told me that Gak, King of Sari, had sent my letter and map to him by a runner, and that he and Job had at once decided to set out on the completion of the fleet to ascertain the correctness of my theory that the Lural Oz, in which the Anorak Islands lay, was in reality the same ocean as that which lapped the shores of Thuria under the name of Sojar Oz, or Great Sea. Their destination had been the island retreat of Hooja, and they had sent word to Ghak of their plans that we might work in harmony with them. The tempest that had blown us off the coast of the continent had blown them far to the south also. Shortly before discovering us, they had come into a great group of islands, from between the largest two of which they were sailing when they saw Hooja's fleet pursuing our dugout. I asked Perry if he had any idea as to where we were, or in what direction lay Hooja's island or the continent. He replied by producing his map, on which he had carefully marked the newly discovered islands. They are described as the Unfriendly Islands, which showed Hooja's island northwest of us about 2 points west. He then explained that with compass, chronometer, log, and reel, they had kept a fairly accurate record of their course from the time they had set out. Four of the feluccas were equipped with these instruments, and all of the captains had been instructed in their use. I was greatly surprised at the ease with which these savages had mastered the rather intricate detail of this unusual work, but Perry assured me that they were a wonderfully intelligent race, and had been quick to grasp all that he had tried to teach them. Another thing that surprised me was the fact that so much had been accomplished in so short a time, for I could not believe that I had been gone from Anorak for a sufficient period to permit of building a fleet of 50 feluccas and mining iron ore for the cannon and balls, to say nothing of manufacturing these guns and the crude muzzle-loading rifles with which every Mesop was armed, as well as the gunpowder and ammunition they had in such ample quantities.
"Time!" exclaimed Perry. "Well, how long were you gone from Anorak before we picked you up in the Sojar Oz?"
That was a puzzler, and I had to admit it. I didn't know how much time had elapsed, and neither did Perry, for time is non-existent in Pellucidar.
"Then you see, David," he continued, "I had almost unbelievable resources at my disposal. The Mesops inhabiting the Anorak Islands, which stretch far out to sea beyond the three principal isles with which you are familiar, number well into the millions, and by the far greater part of them are friendly to Jah. Men, women, and children turned to and worked the moment Jah explained the nature of our enterprise. And not only were they anxious to do all in their power to hasten the day when the Mahars should be overthrown, but, and this counted for most of all, they are simply ravenous for greater knowledge and for better ways of doing things. The contents of the prospector set their imaginations to working overtime, so that they crave to own, themselves, the knowledge which had made it possible for other men to create and build the things which you brought back from the outer world. And then," continued the old man, "the element of time, or rather, lack of time, operated to my advantage. There being no nights, there was no laying off from work. They labored incessantly, stopping only to eat, and on rare occasions to sleep. Once we had discovered iron ore, we had enough mind in an incredibly short time to build 1,000 cannon. I had only to show them once how a thing should be done, and they would fall to work by thousands to do it. Why, no sooner had we fashioned the first muzzle-loader, and they had seen it work successfully, than fully 3,000 Mesops fell to work to make rifles. Of course, there was much confusion and lost motion at first, but eventually Jah got them in hand, detailing squads of them under competent chiefs to certain work. We now have 100 expert gunmakers. On a little isolated isle we have a great powder factory. Near the iron mine, which is on the mainland, is a smelter, and on the eastern shore of Anorak a well-equipped shipyard. All these industries are guarded by forts in which several cannon are mounted and where warriors are always on guard. You would be surprised now, David, at the aspect of Anorak. I am surprised myself. It seems always to me, as I compare it with the day that I first set foot upon it from the deck of the Sari, that only a miracle could have worked the change that has taken place."
"It is a miracle," I said. "It is nothing short of a miracle to transplant all the wondrous possibilities of the 20th century back to the Stone Age. It is a miracle to think that only 500 miles of Earth separate two epochs that are really ages and ages apart.
It is stupendous, Perry. But still more stupendous is the power that you and I wield in this great world. These people look upon us as little less than supermen. We must show them that we are all of that.
We must give them the best that we have, Perry.
Yes, he agreed, we must. I have been thinking a great deal lately that some kind of shrapnel shell or explosive bomb will be a most splendid innovation in their warfare. Then there are breech-loading rifles and those with magazines that I must hasten to study out and learn to reproduce as soon as we get settled down again. And
hold on, Perry, I cried. I didn't mean these sorts of things at all. I said that we must give them the best we have. What we have given them so far has been the worst. We have given them war and the munitions of war. In a single day we have made their wars infinitely more terrible and bloody than in all their past ages they have been able to make them with their crude primitive weapons. In a period that could scarcely have exceeded 2 outer earthly hours, our fleet practically annihilated the largest armada of native canoes that the Pellucidarians ever before had gathered together. We butchered some 8,000 warriors with the 20th-century gifts we brought. Why, they wouldn't have killed that many warriors in the entire duration of a dozen of their wars with their own weapons. No, Perry, we've got to give them something better than scientific methods of killing one another.
The old man looked at me in amazement. There was reproach in his eyes, too.
"Why, David," he said sorrowfully, "I thought that you would be pleased with what I had done. We planned these things together, and I am sure that it was you who suggested practically all of it. I have done only what I thought you wished done, and I have done it the best that I know how."
I laid my hand on the old man's shoulder.
"Bless your heart, Perry," I cried. "You've accomplished miracles. You've done precisely what I should have done, only you've done it better. I'm not finding fault. But I don't wish to lose sight myself, or let you lose sight, of the greater work which must grow out of this preliminary and necessary carnage. First, we must place the Empire upon a secure footing, and we can do so only by putting the fear of us in the hearts of our enemies. But after that... Ah, Perry, that is the day I look forward to. When you and I can build sewing machines instead of battleships, harvesters of crops instead of harvesters of men, plowshares and telephones, schools and colleges, printing presses and paper. When our merchant marine shall ply the great Pellucidarian seas, and cargoes of silks and typewriters and books shall forge their ways where only hideous Saurians have held sway since time began.
Amen, said Perry, and Dian, who was standing at my side, pressed my hand.
End of chapter 14.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices. Plus, extra ways to save. Like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. And up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.